Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Institute for Philosophy and Religion titled, We Live Beyond Any Tale That We Happen to Enact. Our speaker is Galen Strawson from the Department of Philosophy at the University of Reading in the United Kingdom. Responding to Professor Strawson will be Christopher Ricks from the Editorial Institute at Boston University. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Amelie Rorty, Department of Philosophy at Boston University.
Galen Strawson is presently visiting professor at MIT and professor of philosophy at the University of Reading. He began his university studies with Persian and Islamic philosophy at Cambridge, then moved to social and political theory, and finally to philosophy at Oxford. He supplemented all of this with a year at L'École Normale Supérieure. While in Paris, he attended a seminar with Derrida, trying, as he says, with no success, to understand what he was talking about. Returning to England, he served as a lecturer at various colleges at Oxford, while also working as an editorial assistant and reviewer for the Times Literary Supplement. Became a fellow and tutor and philosophy at Jesus College in 1987, but also took time to be a visiting professor at NYU and Rutgers, as well as a visiting research fellow at the School of Social Sciences in Canberra. A regular but episodic visitor at the CUNY Graduate Center, he became distinguished professor of philosophy there in 2004-2006. Although Galen says he didn't publish any work in philosophy until 1986, there has since been an explosion of articles, often collected in books, in The Philosophy of Mind, on free will and so-called responsibility, on consciousness and intentionality, on Hume, on varieties of materialism and realism. His striking and influential essays against narrativity and episodic selves have been included in his 2008 volume, Real Materialism and Other Essays. His most recent book, Selves, an Essay in Revisionary Metaphysics, appeared in 2009. We are promised, maybe it's more of a hint than a promise, a sequel, Life in Time. As a consultant editor of TLS and reviewer for numerous papers and journals, his work has been enriched by his wide-ranging engagement with literature. He is an arbiter of all that is well and alive in philosophy. The title of his lecture today is a quotation from V.S. Pritchett, "We live beyond any tale that we happen to enact." After his lecture, Professor Christopher Ricks, now since June 2009, Professor Sir Christopher Ricks, the William M. and Susan B. Warren Professor of the Humanities and co-director of the Editorial Institute at Boston University, will offer comments. Formerly the professor of poetry at Oxford, he has edited numerous classical collections of poetry, among them The Golden Treasury and the Oxford Book of English Verse. Professor Ricks has written influential studies of Milton, of Keats, Tennyson, of Bob Dylan, and Beckett. A strong and influential critic, an exacting critic of critics, he is, at the request of the Eliot Estate, presently preparing a full critical edition of T.S. Eliot's Complete Poems. And now, we live beyond any tale that we happen to and act.
Thanks very much. If one is narrative, then, and this is my first definition, one experiences or construes or conceives one's life as a narrative or story of some sort. Or one experiences or construes or conceives parts of one's life as in this way, even if one doesn't do this to one's life taken as a whole. To be narrative, as I'm going to use the term, is to have a certain psychological characteristic, a psychological style or outlook. It is, in the first instance, a natural disposition, even if it's open to cultivation. The narrativity or the lack of it is a natural dimension of human psychological difference, whatever the possible effects of training or cultural influence. Well, what is it? According to Oliver Sacks, I quote, each of us constructs and lives a narrative. This narrative is us, our identities. According to Jerry Bruner, self is a perpetually rewritten story. And I quote again, in the end, we become the autobiographical narratives by which we tell about our lives. Maria Schechtman claims, I quote, that one creates one's identity by forming an autobiographical narrative, a story of one's life. And Dan Dennett says, quoting again, we're all virtuoso novelists who find ourselves engaged in all sorts of behavior, and we always try to put the best faces on it we can. We try to make all our material cohere into a single good story, and that story is our autobiography. The chief fictional character at the center of that autobiography is oneself. Well, I do think this gives the initial idea. And all those I've quoted and many others think that all normal people are narrative. Well, I disagree. Some of us aren't narrative at all. Some of us don't cast or construe our lives as a narrative or story of some sort, and we don't experience parts of our lives in this way either. We may simply not be reflective about these things, or we may be like Bob Dylan. I'm quoting, I don't think I'm tangible to myself. I mean, I think one thing today and I think another thing tomorrow. I change during the course of a day. I wake and I'm one person, and when I go to sleep, I know for certain I'm somebody else. I don't know who I am most of the time, and it doesn't even matter to me. Or my other witness, the poet Samuel Hanagide, 1,000 years ago. He writes, for my part, there is no difference at all between my own days, which have gone by, and the distant days of Noah, about which I have heard. I have nothing in the world but the hour in which I am. It pauses for a moment, and then, like a cloud, moves on. Well, the narrativity theorists admonish Dylan, look, everyone's narrative. Your I'm one thing today, another thing tomorrow thing is just part of your narrative about yourself. And certainly Dylan has told a lot of stories when questioned about himself. But this, if anything, confirms the accuracy of his remark. As for the great Samuel Hanagide, spice merchant, warrior, tax collector, grand vizier to the King of Granada, I think that the narrativity theorists should treat him with great care. At the very least, people vary greatly when it comes to the basic narrative impulse. If you think about your friends for a while, I think you'll see how they differ in this respect. And this difference is what I'm getting at by saying that some people are narrative and some aren't. Well, the narrativity theorists may concede that some people don't appear to be narrative, but claim that they are really. It's just that they're doing it unconsciously or implicitly. And they, that's the narrativity theorists, may back up their claim by referring to the deep human drive to make sense of things, to find patterns and explanations at all costs, and where necessary, to confabulate in the technical sense of experimental psychology. That is, to make up, invent patterns and explanations where there are none to be found. Here again, though, we have to do with a central human individual difference, a psychological variable, a trait which is strong in some and weak in others. Keats congratulated Shakespeare on his extreme negative capability, his capacity to rest in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason, the sort of irritability that can easily lead to confabulation. And I think we need a good dose of negative capability when it comes to our attitude to ourselves and our own lives. I think we should cultivate it. I suspect that it's sounder, closer to life, than the dangerous reachings of narrative self-interpretation, let alone those of narrative self-constitution. For as Nietzsche says, I quote again, if the hare has 7 skins, the human being can shed 7 times 70 skins and still not be able to say, this is really you, this is no longer outer shell. Well, Nietzsche may well be exaggerating, and I can hear a voice, it might be Maria Schechtman's, telling me that there are things that people mean by the expression narrative self-constitution that I can't possibly wish to reject. Well, that may be so. For the moment, if the narrativity theorists insist that we're all really narrative, I'll disagree vehemently, and then begin to wonder whether they're defining narrativity in such a way that their thesis comes out as trivially true. So when McAdams and others say, I quote, we are all storytellers and we are the stories we tell, what is consciousness but an inner narration of experience? They seem to understand narration in a way that does land them in triviality. And the threat of triviality is real, even if they don't go so far. Still, I could try to work with them by proposing that all the striking or interesting differences between people that I'm trying to mark, by saying that some people are narrative and others aren't, re-emerge inside their framework. There are the Dan Dennetts, on the one hand, trying to make all of their life material cohere into single story, and the Bob Dylans, on the other, who are doing no such thing. There are people like Charles Taylor, who hold, I quote, that a basic condition of making sense of ourselves is that we grasp our lives in a narrative and have an understanding of our lives as an unfolding story. And then there are people like me who find this idea of engaging in this sort of activity profoundly alien, people who believe that they can get on quite well without it, whether or not they also think that it's a royal road to error. Well, I'm not saying anyone's right or wrong, not yet. I'm just saying we're different, hugely different. Proponents of virtue ethics tend to tell us that there's one right way to be. Aristotle, for example, tells us that we should, before all else, possess the four cardinal virtues of courage, temperance, practical wisdom, and justice. And these are surely all very good things to have. But even here, we need to recognize the fact and importance of human difference. We need to recognize the very different forms that human virtue can take, given the vast field of human imperfection. There seems, for example, to be people whose virtues are forms of their failings, people whose gifts depend on their faults, people who inspire love and respect, although they are rackety, partial, inconsistent, and comically faint-hearted. And I chose those four adjectives because each of them denies one of the cardinal virtues. There are, on the one hand, heroes and wise maidens with oil lamps, and there are, on the other hand, Don Quixotes, Fitzcarraldos, Shirley MacLaine figures, Uncle Tobys, and Papagenos. There are people whose charm is inextricable from their rashness or naughtiness, people whose creative energies are constitutively linked to their cowardice or bad temper, people whose particular insight and humor depend on certain sorts of injustice and unfairness, people whose special capacities for generosity and great-heartedness are inseparable from their intemperance, people whose moral charm, a category stressed by Isaiah Berlin, is bound up with their lack of practical wisdom. So, we shouldn't be too quick or grand when we try to generalize about the human condition, either about how it is or how it ought to be. This is familiar. So, I've already quoted Dennett, Sachs, Bruner, and others who endorse what I call the psychological narrativity thesis. This states that all normal people conceive their own lives in a narrative way and live in and through this conception. So it's an empirical, descriptive thesis about the way ordinary, normal human beings experience and live their lives. This is how we are, it says. This is our nature. They also endorse a distinct thesis, which I'll call the narrative self-constitution thesis, and that's well expounded by Schechtman. According to the narrative self-constitution thesis, your narrative of your own life, constitutes your identity as a person or self. The most prolific exponent of this view, perhaps, is Dan McAdams. He propounds what he calls the life story theory of identity. He claims, and I quote, that identity is itself a life story. Here's a longer quotation. Beginning in late adolescence and young adulthood, he says, we construct integrative narratives of the self that selectively recall the past and wishfully anticipate the future to provide our lives with some semblance of unity, purpose, and identity. Personal identity is the internalized and evolving life story that each of us is working on as we move through our adult lives. He says, I do not really know who I am until I have a good understanding of my narrative identity. Well, I have an identity and I have a life story, but I'm jiggered if my identity is my life story. But putting that aside, the thing I want to note at this point is that A and B, that's the psychological narrativity thesis and the narrative self-constitution thesis, are distinct. Because you can endorse the first, the view that we're all narrative if normal, without endorsing the second, the view that we actually constitute our identity in that way. Well, neither of those theses has any evaluative implications. Both so far are merely empirical or theoretical. But they do have evaluative or normative forms. And I'm going to call the normative version of the psychological narrativity thesis This is C, the ethical narrativity thesis. According to this, one ought to have a narrative outlook on one's life. It's essential to a good life, essential to living well, essential, in fact, to true or full personhood. Well, we can illustrate this view by supposing that Socrates is right when he famously says that the unexamined life is not a life for a human being. He's right that we ought to be reflective about our lives. I'm not sure this is a universal human truth, in fact, but let's assume that it is for now. Then we can take the ethical narrativity thesis to be the thesis that we ought to reflect about our lives in a narrative way, in the narrative framework. Well, this view is widely held today, and it's usually part of the normative version of the narrative self-constitution thesis, which I'll call the ethical narrative self-constitution thesis. It's a bit of a mouthful, but these four positions are, in fact, all distinct. According to this, your identity as a personal self ought to be constituted by your narrative, your own story of how your life is going. The two ethical theses are also distinct because you can endorse the first, the claim that we ought to be narrative, without endorsing the second, which is the more specific claim that you ought to constitute your identity in a narrative way. In practice, though, most of those who hold the first also hold the second. So we have so far four connected theses. A thesis about how we do normally think about ourselves and our lives, a thesis about how we ought to do this, a thesis about how our identity gets constituted, and a thesis about how it ought to get constituted. Well, I'm going to put aside the issue of self-constitution for a moment and consider only A and C. That's the psychological narrativity thesis and the ethical narrativity thesis. We then have four positions. First position. The descriptive psychological thesis is true, but the ethical thesis is false. That is, we are indeed deeply narrative in our thinking about ourselves, but it's not a good thing. It leads to self-deception, bad faith, inauthenticity. And this view is well known to be associated with Jean-Paul Sartre. But I'll also call the great second century Stoic Marcus Aurelius as a witness. Second position. The descriptive thesis is false and the ethical thesis is true. That is, we're not all naturally narrative in our thinking about ourselves, but we should be. We need to be in order to live a good life. So Bob Dylan needs to start narrativizing before it's too late. This is a common view today, and it has also respectable ancestry. For example, the first century historian and philosopher Plutarch. Third position, both theses are true. Both the psychological narrativity thesis, according to which all normal, non-pathological human beings are naturally narrative, and the ethical narrativity thesis, according to which being narrative is crucial to a good life. This does seem to be the most popular view in the academy today, followed by the second view. It doesn't entail that everything is as it should be. It leaves plenty of room for the idea that many of us would profit from being more narrative than we are, and also leaves room for the idea that we can narrativize ourselves badly and do it and learn to do it better. Fourth and final position, both views are false. This is my view. I don't think it's true that there's only one general way in which non-pathological human beings think about themselves when they think about themselves in the larger, more overarching way that's present in question, the narrative way. And I don't think there's only one good way for them to do so, the narrative way. There are deeply non-narrative people, and there are good ways to live that are deeply non-narrative. There are people who live well who are not only not naturally narrative in their temporal temperament, where this is something merely negative. There are people who are naturally strongly anti-narrative, where this is something positive. People like this not only lack any inclination to cast, conceive, construe, and conduct their lives or parts of their lives in a narrative way, they also find it peculiarly hard to do. They're likely to stumble and stall in recounting events in their lives. And this is principally because they have a strong sense that something is getting positively misrepresented or falsified insofar as the events are being strung together into a narrative. Okay, now for two more positions and an adjustment. Having established these four basic positions, I want to bring back the narrative self-constitution thesis, along with its normative version. The non-normative version, recall, says that your narrative of your own life constitutes your identity as a personal self. The normative version says that one's identity as a personal self ought to be constituted by one's narrative. The dominant view in the academy and the clinic, I think, is that both these theses are also true. So proponents of this view hold a full house. We're naturally narrative, we ought to be, we constitute our identity in this way, and we ought to. I'm at the other end. We're not all naturally narrative, it's rarely, if ever, a good thing. We don't constitute our identity in this way, and we nor ought we to. Now I want to begin to go on the offensive against narrativity. If the narrativity thesis is the main thesis in town, we need the antithesis, the antithesis. The Aufhebung can wait. So I'm going to proceed in two stages. Here's stage one, where one of the things I'm aiming at is vulnerability to objection. I've already allowed, for the sake of argument, that Socrates is right, that we ought to think about or examine ourselves in a wide, general, life-assessing way. We ought to engage in what he calls hexatasis, or more specifically, autohexatasis, self-examination. And I'm actually going to use the Greek word because it's unfamiliar, and that means it's theoretically unencumbered. So this gives the following question. Does autohexatasis, or hexatasis for short, essentially involve narrative or narrativity? If I have to be hexatatic, examine myself, do I have to be narrative? Is the narrative way the best way, even if it's not the only way? I say no and no. I can put down a clear marker straight away, and this might cause dissent, by saying that I don't think hexatasis involves narrativity, even when it involves therapy that pays special attention to past life, especially early life. Well, perhaps this shows that I understand the notion of narrative in a narrower way than others. So be it. I don't think that deriving therapeutic benefit from grasping and emotionally appreciating causal connections between one's early life experiences and one's current travails need involve any sort of specifically or distinctively narrative thinking, any more than learning that the scar on one's finger is due to an early fall. In most cases, I think therapy delivers a rather disparate clutch of insight elements that cast light severally on this and that. The insight elements don't themselves make up a narrative sequence, nor is the way each one casts light individually a narrative matter. Truth here is mostly a matter of fragments and oddments. And smooth narrative is in danger of being fantasy. I certainly don't want to rule out the possibility that successful therapy or hexatasis should, in certain cases, have a specifically narrative form. But if we measure therapeutic success partly by reference to getting at the truth, rather than just by reference to restoring or increasing everyday fitness for life, then I think the possibility of success grows slimmer. No, say the narrativists, the facts are these. Almost all causal explanation of features of concrete reality, in this case features of oneself, one's personality, one's present situation, involves identifying links between past and present. And when one's subject is oneself and one's life, all identification of links between past and present involves narrative. Granted, they say, this is still them, this may not be true or interestingly true in the case of many explanations of features of oneself, medical and genetic explanations, for example, to do with eyesight and shoe size, but it is going to be true in the case of many of the most interesting characterological or more generally psychological explanations. This means, they say, that hexatasis is bound to involve narrative as soon as it involves causal explanation, past-present linking. And it's bound to involve a considerable amount of highly substantive causal explanation if it's going to get anywhere, so it must, after all, involve a considerable amount of highly substantive narrative. In sum and in brief, they say, we have an argument, premise one. Hexatasis requires causal explanation, past-present linking. Premise two, causal explanation is necessarily narrative when one's subject is oneself and one's life. Conclusion, hexatasis is necessarily narrative. Well, the argument is valid, but not sound, in my view. I reject both premises. As for premise one, I don't think hexatasis necessarily involves causal explanation. I think with Proust, among others, that it often involves such simple things as discovering something about what really matters most to one. But although I don't think that hexatasis necessarily involves causal explanation, I do think that it very often involves causal explanation. So I'm prepared to grant premise one for the sake of argument, but not premise two. I reject premise two. Causal explanation, psychologically significant causal explanation, isn't always narrative. I think it can be, in an intuitive sense, anti-narrative. I can have no story of development, but capture an isolated key explanatory connection between past and present, a kind of arc of electric contact that reaches above and is utterly independent of all the developmental progression involving details of my life. Well, so much for hexatasis, self-examination. Now for the more frontal assault. And I haven't got this probably worked out yet, so I'm going to bring in a team of supporters. On my team, I have, for a start, or so I believe, people like Proust, Emerson, Woolf, Virginia Woolf, and at least one avatar of Nietzsche, Nietzsche has, it seems, as many avatars as the Hindu god Vishnu, and at least one of them is on the other team, I am aware of that. Well, this initial list may sink some people's hearts on the ground that these people are just too sensitive, too highly strung. As Emily put it to me, they're a mite hyper. But they're well counterbalanced by the bluntness of other team members, like the great short story writer V.S. Pritchett, who's the source of my title, and the incomparable Chekhov, who inspired Pritchett. Kierkegaard has also been claimed by both sides in the narrativity debate. Kierkegaard starts well for me by saying that one shouldn't, I quote, try to arrange oneself dramatically in time or in temporality. This sounds to me like a direct criticism of narrativity, an exact rejection of the Alistair MacIntyre, Charles Taylor project. Kierkegaard's most famous remark on this subject runs as follows, I quote, philosophy is perfectly right in saying that life must be understood backwards, but then one forgets the other clause, that it must be lived forwards. The more one thinks through this clause, the more one concludes that life in temporality never becomes properly understandable, simply because never at any time does one get perfect repose to take a stance backwards. Well, this passage has probably been cited in support of the narrative cause. Seems to me, though, that it rejects the idea that one should make use of a story of oneself in living forwards, i.e. in living, because there isn't any other way to live. Your narrative is something you work out, perhaps, if you want to, looking back, but you shouldn't let it dictate your stance to the future. Rather, the contrary, when it comes to dictation. Proust considers days when one finds oneself outside the regular tenor of life. There are days when one is more inward. They're not days on which one finds oneself in a special position to appreciate what one has made of oneself. They're days when one is simply more at home to what one just is, independently of any making. To le vrai moi, as Proust calls it, the true me or true self, to which there is on these days some kind of reconnection. Reconnection, of course, implies loss of connection. One has been caught up in one's daily life in a way that is in some respect alienated one from oneself. Perhaps one's been caught up in one's narrative in a way that has alienated one from oneself. How could this be? Because one lives beyond any tale that one happens to enact. Proust gives great weight to what he calls involuntary memories, upsurgings of past episodes of extreme happiness. What they do is teach you about yourself as nothing else can. They're rare and fundamental data. These data come from the past, to be sure, but it doesn't follow that they have anything to do with narrative. On the contrary, they offer him isolated clues. They're complete in themselves in respect of their probative force. Self-knowledge centrally involves things like this, suddenly realizing that one really loves something, something which is likely to seem quite trivial from most points of view. So Proust's greatest revelations come, here are four examples, come from the feel of a starched napkin, the sensation of uneven flagstones under his feet, hearing a spoon clink on glass, and the most famous one, dipping a biscuit in tea. Such things, perhaps, are the fundamental clues to self. under all one's skins, of which there are at least 490, as according to Nietzsche. Emerson, the local boy, the American Nietzsche, who was deeply admired by Nietzsche, adds this in his roaring essay on self-reliance, I'm quoting, "What is the aboriginal self? The inquiry leads us to that source which we call spontaneity or instinct or intuition. Every man discriminates between the voluntary acts of his mind and his involuntary perceptions and knows that to his involuntary perceptions a perfect faith is due. He may err in the expression of them, but he knows that these things are so, like day and night, not to be disputed. All my willful actions and acquisitions are but roving. The idlest reverie, the faintest native emotion, command my curiosity and respect." If Emerson's got anything right here, it's a colossal blow against those who champion self-constitution by willful choice and action. His principal message is that we're reliably accessible to ourselves only by intuition, that we need to listen for ourselves. We're pieces of fate, in Nietzsche's phrase. We wander most blindly, precisely when we try to regiment ourselves. Things aren't up to us. We ourselves are not up to us. And he takes this point to its a very fierce conclusion, which I'll quote. "Nothing at last is sacred but the integrity of your own mind. I remember an answer which, when quite young, I was prompted to make a valued advisor, who was wont to importune me with the dear old doctrines of the church. On my saying, 'What have I to do with the sacredness of traditions if I live wholly from within?' my friend suggested, 'But these impulses may be from below, not from above.' I replied, 'They do not seem to me to be such, but if I am the devil's child, I will live then from the devil. No law can be sacred to me but that of my nature. Good and bad are but names, very readily transferable to this or that. The only right is what is after my constitution, the only wrong what is against it.'" Well, that does seem too much. If it seems too much, I think you have to remember that Emerson is betting on the basic goodness, or at least the good enoughness, of untainted human being. Kant, by contrast, believes in radical evil. But Emerson is at one with Kant in his paean to autonomy when he says, I quote, that no law can be sacred to me but that of my nature. Even as he reverses the aspirations of those in the present day who seek autonomy and self-constitution. So he agrees with Nietzsche, Emerson, that is, that you should become what you are. That's a quotation from Nietzsche. Well, it may be objected that you can't fail to become what you are because it's tautological that you are at any stage of your life what you have thus far become. But Emerson's and Nietzsche's point is precisely that it's all too possible that you can fail to become what you are. Well, I think that's enough, Emerson and Nietzsche. I'm sure we should get in touch with ourselves, and cheesiness is no enemy of truth. But it's probably more a matter of luck than endeavour if you do so, and it's not really my present concern. My conclusion, which is, I hope, gathering itself, is plain. To take one's narrative to constitute one's identity, and in that sense to identify oneself with one's narrative, seems to be a strangely and perhaps murderously reductive act. Here's some more considerations. One of the most important things about several people I know is that they have no sense of humour. I don't mean they're grim or unsmiling. They may be convivial and charming. They may tell jokes and be good at it. They may be good at knowing when something is a joke and making laughter sounds. But they have no sense of humor. It's striking at first that lack of sense of humor can be an absolute lack. But we're increasingly familiar with the idea that individuals can have very specific psychological deficits. Prosopagnosia, for example, a complete inability to recognize faces. And the present point, in any case, is simply that a sense of humour, or more saliently, complete lack of sense of humour, is a foundational feature of identity. When one analyses someone's nature or character, their essential identity, if we can have such a thing, one considers these general things, which are not a function of their life or their narrative of their life. More generally, one needs to consider a person's position in the great vector space or state space of character traits, which once had four main parameters: sanguine, melancholy, phlegmatic, and choleric, and now has five. This is the so-called big five. These are the bipolar categories: extroversion, introversion, neuroticism, non-neuroticism, agreeableness, disagreeableness, conscientiousness, irresponsibility, and openness and closeness to experience. So that's one point. That's not nothing to do with narrative. Next thing, we need to add in all the evidence that we just don't really know what's going on with ourselves. This evidence is copious, and it comes in a variety of forms. There's the abiding truth in Freudianism. Then there's a completely non-Freudian notion of the adaptive unconscious, discussed by Timothy Wilson in his well-titled book, Strangers to Ourselves. This is the unconscious mind as acknowledged in cognitive science, a vast repertoire of mental processes that influence our judgments and decisions in ways inaccessible to consciousness. It turns out to do a great deal of the running of one's life, especially when things go well, sometimes with little regard for one's conscious elucubrations. So that's another point. Then there are the tremendously discomforting results of so-called situationism in psychology, particularly social psychology. These results are constantly being added to, and they retain their power in spite of the rehabilitation in the last 20 years or so of the idea of character traits in psychology, to which situationism was opposed. The lesson of situationism is that we're constantly being moved by things of which we're wholly unaware. So it seems that the more you identify with your explicit narrative of yourself, the less you know what is really going on. And here is, I'm just going to adapt William Blake. Never seek to tell thy life, life that never told can be, for the gentle wind doth move silently, invisibly. Well, none of this is to say that one can't plan a life's work or pursue great projects. It's not to say that one can't try to be good or become good. For that, though, one need never look further than the present. It simply raises doubts about the practice of self-narrative, about the value of being narrative, and about the goal of narrative self-constitution, about the extent to which it risks being a form of self-abuse. Well, I've tried to present the antithesis to the narrative thesis. There's a great deal more to say about all this, but this is as far as I've got at present.
I shall do my duty mostly by talking about the first half of the paper, because like you, I've just heard the paper for the first time, and I needed, whether I were a philosopher or not, to do some preparation before commenting on this. The phrase that Professor Strawson uses in the two essays, and I'll spend a fair amount of time talking about the two essays, Against Narrativity and Episodic Ethics. And I'll talk about those partly because I had the chance to read them in advance and partly because they do furnish the first half of the talk that we've just heard. So what might somebody who comes from literature notice? Well, I had we world enough and time, I would want to talk about the rhetoric within the talk and more particularly the rhetoric within the essays. We did hear today, rarely if ever, where I want to task the person whether it doesn't make a great difference, whether it is rarely or whether it is never. Rarely, if ever, seems to me to glide over a real difficulty repeatedly, as do some other phrases. One has little or no sense that the self. Now, does one have some sense that the self, or really no sense that the self, and so on. So these phrases are, I think, important to those of us. I mean, I don't mean they're not important to a philosopher and to this philosopher in particular, but they're a way in which somebody who comes from literature and the way in which language is used in literature, and such literature being, of course, very beautifully used in the talk today. The key question for me is whether it's built into all philosophy or only into the shape that this talk takes, that the question must always be, is this true or false, and never, what truth is there in this? To that question, it might be answered, none at all, but there's a prima facie implausibility. A position, for instance, held by people who are not stupid, as Alistair MacIntyre is not stupid, is unlikely to have no truth in it at all. But it's true that the drive in philosophy is towards true and false. And you'll notice that the most compacted moment in the first half of the talk is when you can go through all these things and say, this is true, this is true, this is false, this is false. You can believe the first bit's true and the second bit's false. So I want to some degree to go back to Coleridge's sense that in philosophy too, the question what truth is there in this is often just as important a question as is this true? And that I think is not that is not really allowed by the way in which this particular argument is mounted. So that would seem to me to be part of what is at issue. That is, there's a very important moment when in one of the essays, it's put like this. Given the popularity of narrativity, is there some burden on me to explain the popularity of the two theses, given that I think that they're false? Hardly. Theorizing human beings tend to favor false views in matters of this kind, and it's the intellectual fashion. Now, hardly there is a terrific piece of rhetoric, but it's not altogether proper. Do you or do you not have an obligation to explain? And I think Bernard Williams was quite right to rebuke Nozick for being insufficiently interested in how a great philosopher had come to believe something that was not true. That is, I think Williams is right to think that part of the philosopher's job is not only to point out that something is wrong, but to help us understand and imagine how it can have gone wrong. What was it? And I don't think intellectual fashion or original sin, which is what seems to be being posited here, oddly enough, given Professor Strawson's relation to religion in general and Christianity in particular, there's some feeling that, well, theorizing human beings tend to favor false views. I think that leaves too much still to be explained. So let me take a few of my 10 or 12 minutes to read you this short piece by Beckett. So this is As the Story Was Told. It's striking immediately that the story begins, as the story was told me. So you're immediately moving from a title, which is simply As the Story Was Told, to something. So I just want to read this, and part of my question will be, and it's genuinely a question, not an assertion, has this story got hold of some truth about the relationship of identity and self-knowledge to narration, whether of yourself or of somebody else, that the argument as it's set up purely in the present terms can't really turn to? As the story was told me, I never went near the place during sessions. I asked what place, and a tent was described at length, a small tent, the colour of its surroundings. Wearying of this description, I asked what sessions, and these in their turn are described, their object, duration, frequency, and harrowing nature. I hope I was not more sensitive than the next man, but finally I had to raise my hand. I lay there quite still for a time, then asked where I was while all this was going forward. In a hut, was the answer, a small hut in a grove, some 200 yards away, a distance even the loudest cry could not carry, but must die on the way, and so on. Now this, and it comes back again, as the story was told me, and of course there's no way in which the human voice can render what it is to have begun with as the story was told and move in. Now Beckett is the great writer who supposes that without narration of stories in general and some attempt at one's own story in particular, despite all the terrible dangers that lie around this, human life is in many ways terrifically restricted. So I offer Beckett as a something, not a counter-argument, but as an instance which ought to move one to ask, what kind of truth is there in the idea that creating a story of oneself, as Beckett's consciousnesses repeatedly do, brings something by way of comfort and consolation and wisdom? And there's an important moment in one of the essays when Professor Strawson says of something that it is, he says of it that it's very dangerous, as if to show that something were dangerous was to show that it was wrong. A great many of the most valuable things in life are very dangerous, and it seemed to me that the antitheses work often strangely within the argument. One antithesis has disappeared completely from the story as we now hear it, and that is the antithesis of narrative or narrativity, which was episodic. And it was episodic throughout the essay against narrativity, and then had an essay to itself in episodic ethics. Now, I think it's wise and prudent that it is no longer part of the story, because I think it was immensely vulnerable as an argument. That is, episodic is one of the ways in which narrative is maintained or prosecuted. It's not true that there's a contrast of narrative and episodic. And Henry James, whom Professor Strawson uses with great skill as the opening of both of those essays, Henry James says very clearly, in the opening paragraph of his astonishing review of Middlemarch in 1873, to have had Henry James write a review of Middlemarch, I mean, that might almost make somebody believe in the Christian God. We can well remember how keenly we wondered, while its earlier chapters unfolded themselves, what turn in the way of form the story would take. That of an organized, molded, balanced composition, gratifying the reader with a sense of design and construction, or a mere chain of episodes broken into accidental lengths and unconscious of the influence of plan. That is, within story, you've got a balanced composition and you've got the episodic. And it is to me a great surprise that in both of the essays, the notion of the picaresque is taken to be identical with the episodic. Episodic doesn't make sense except by bringing it into relation to narrative. That is, episodic is a way of describing narrative, and picaresque is assuredly a way of describing narrative. Narrative that moves much more away from clear concatenations than many other narratives would do. So I feel that a price is paid now for the fact that there isn't an antithesis to narrative. There's now this convenient thing called non-narrative. Now, that I find non-narrative empty in the way in which I find non-fiction empty. It was a terrible moment in human history when suddenly it was decided that things were either fiction or non-fiction. It's like the moments in political philosophy when things are either Marxist or non-Marxist. The monopoly that Marxism or that fiction commands in that way. And I think the argument does require a way of describing. The earlier essays say, perfectly openly, I am an episodic. It's as if you need Episodics Anonymous. It's something terrible about becoming an episodic. Not in the slightest. Absolutely not. I don't have a trace in me of ever thinking about my past self and my future self as anything other than something I need to know about, but in no way as something that should be considered by me in the instant. Now, as I say, I think the earlier forms of the argument, they're very, very powerful, but they're also terrifically vulnerable, because the episodic thing doesn't really make sense. It's like Eliot saying that without the implication of a system into which things fit, a fact is not a fact at all. And without the implication of a narrative which is in some ways being challenged or subverted, the notion of an episode does not make sense. So I think that if I'm allowed to sort of give advice in the matter, the next stage, I think, should be, having quite rightly thrown episodicism to the winds, and so episode that, and so on as he throws it out, what is going to come along and take its place, so that we don't have all the time the narrative character person being characterized with the non-narrative one. Now that's castrative, I think. What do I want to say at the end? I want to say that I think the arguments are very beautifully humanized by the lovely quotations in the end. The second half was not only an anthology, but it was an anthology, and that's one of the very good things that somebody can put before us, these very, very telling and beautiful passages. I think a key thing is that the narrative is not the only form of pattern. And we did hear of pattern today, but without a sufficient investigation of what the difference between a pattern and other form finding is. That is, the argument is that we are all in the form finding business. We all seek form. Now, pattern is not narrative. It is a wonderful relief and release from narrative. Eliot is quite right to praise Valérie for understanding that it is not our feelings, but the pattern that we make of our feelings that is the value. So, and it's not a story that we tell about the feelings, it's the pattern that we make. So there's something in the spatial metaphor as against the temporal one of pattern that goes at one of the kinds of form that could be. I agree with the argument we heard today, though it's more fully voiced in the essays, that storytelling is a species of form finding, and that form finding is perfectly possible without storytelling. That seems to me to be true, but then we have to ask, what is it about stories? What kinds of truth might they get at for us that other kinds don't? I think the Pritchett remark, which is clearly very important emotionally to the argument, is perfectly compatible with the narrative. We live beyond any tale that we happen to enact. Happen to is doing a lot of work there on Pritchett's behalf. Enact is a word with a very, very important word. Michael Silk has written very, very well in the magazine Dialogos about the way in which enact became such an important part of the critical vocabulary for literature. But it's also that we live beyond any tale that we happen to enact is true, but that's true of everything. We live beyond anything that we can voice in words. We live beyond any argument about whether one is episodic or narrative. We live beyond anything that we can conceivably imagine. And I think it's one of the reasons why Pritchett is not as great a writer as it's now suited a lot of people to maintain, that he too much believed or had a certain view of what it was that he had just said when he wrote those memorable words. P.S. I think Charles Griswold's book on forgiveness is an astonishing work, and I hope that these two gentlemen will debate, because it's a very important part of Galen Strawson's argument that forgiveness is and memory are compatible with your not having some sense that you yourself, an asterisked person. I was hoping today he was going to speak the asterisks. They're terrifically important in the printed form, and I was waiting for some amazing glottal stop or something like that. I thought it was going to be some kind of spittoon brought forward so that we can hear a man say an asterisk and so on. But I think the argument between Charles and Galen would be extremely interesting in this, and I assume that it's a very important tenor of Charles's book, that narrative is in some crucial ways indispensable. There are certain things you can do if you tell stories that you can't if you don't tell stories. Thank you very much.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Galen Strawson from the Department of Philosophy at the University of Reading in the United Kingdom. Professor Strawson's lecture was titled, We Live Beyond Any Tale That We Happen to Enact. It was presented by the Boston University Institute for Philosophy and Religion. Responding to Professor Strawson was Christopher Ricks from the Editorial Institute at Boston University. Tonight's moderator was Amelie Rorty from the Department of Philosophy at Boston University. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Alden Fertig. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.